from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan. Today I have a special guest. She is a linguist, a writer, and a paranormal investigator, and I thought I should bring her on the show because there are certain elements in the skeptical community that I wouldn't say get ignored, but sometimes they have a bit of a lesser priority because, you know, I think we like to go after the big fish. And we forget about the tons of little fish that are around. And well, I'm sorry, I should probably use the word sharks rather than fish. And here to tell me all about these types of people, what their mentality is, all the kinds of different techniques they're using. My guest today is Karen Stolznow. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Jacob. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. Now, one of the things that made me aware of you first was your talk at the Amazing Meeting. There's going to be a link for it in the notes. And in it, you talked about a variety of different skeptical issues in terms of the paranormal. It seemed as though you were trying to really help to classify and codify what seems to still be a little bit of a muddied issue. Do you feel like there's little awareness of the minutiae of skepticism, or I mean of psychics, and that's why you want to do this?
I think what I was really trying to do is push a forthcoming book of mine called Language, Myths, Mysteries, and Magic, and that's why I was talking about those particular topics and talking about my background in linguistics and the relevance of that to skepticism. I've had many people ask me over the years, why would a linguist be skeptical? What does linguistics have to offer to skepticism? So that's really what I was talking about or wanting to make clear, that language and communication is a major part of a lot of these paranormal techniques and pseudoscientific beliefs and theories, and I was just trying to draw attention to that.
Well, it was interesting. One of the things that really struck me was actually a point that you had made about chain letters. And specifically, it was the fact that chain letters, according to at least Richard Dawkins, seem to resemble a virus. And I wanted to ask, what is it about a chain letter that is so appealing to people? Why do they persist? Why are they so, you know, pervasive?
Well, I received my first chain letter when I was maybe about 5 or 6 years old when I was in school. And it's was full of threats, and of course they have this particular structure. They all seem to go along the same lines, and they usually ask you to replicate the letter somehow, which is why Dawkins paralleled that to a virus. But they always contain some kind of threat that if you don't pass this on, if you don't replicate it and send it on to other people, then you're going to die, you're going to have bad luck, something evil is going to happen to you. However, if you do pass the letter on, if you do replicate it, then you're going to have some kind of good luck. You might get a new job, you might win the lottery, something positive is going to happen to you. So I think that there is this sort of Pascal's wager for the paranormal when it comes to chain letters, where people think, well, I guess it's not going to hurt if I do send this on. And certainly when it comes to email chain letters today, it's just as simple as forwarding an email. So there's that possibility that it might work, that there might be something to it, especially if it's a free meal at Applebee's or a free iPad. It's worth the risk for people to try, and also just avoiding the possibility that something bad could happen to them. So I think it's just a product of us being a little bit superstitious about things and just giving it a go just in case.
Well, the chain letter seems to have a very strong correlation with religion itself, that you use, there's a fear tactic that you employ, and that can be fairly easy if you just point towards any natural disaster and saying, we did something wrong, and this is going to happen again, and then reinforce that with, hey, but if you do what we tell you, there's going to be lots of benefits and so on and so forth.
Oh, yes, and one of the precursors to chain letters was a thing called letters from heaven. And these were some kind of Christian narrative, some kind of parable or a story out of the Bible that people would make a copy of, and usually there'd be some kind of iconic religious picture on there as well. And people would carry this around for good luck. I mean, these things have been done for hundreds of years. So soldiers would take them to war to protect themselves against being killed, and just the general person would carry it around hoping that they're going to prevent misfortune and attract good luck. So, yeah, these things have been around for a long time, and they do have a religious basis. And they actually appear in across cultures and across time as well. So they are used in Islam. They are used in Hinduism. So it's just another one of those things that is quite common to humans.
Is there a commonality in terms of, like, is there an element, perhaps, of exploiting things financially as well? Like, is there a financial component in a lot of these, or is that just added on later? Because I've noticed very often that chain letters have some kind of donate this, or, you know, like, there's often a money component. Is that just an element to attract people, or is that a common thing that we've seen in across chain letters?
I think there are lots of different categories of chain letters, and one of those is financial law, or there's some kind of monetary gain that is promised. If you these go back to there was a spend a dime or save a dime, and I wish I could remember exactly what the name of this particular fraud was anyway, but it goes back to the 1930s where someone had started what is essentially, as we would know it today, a pyramid scheme, and you would send this chain letter on to a number of people, and then they would send it back to you with some money enclosed, and then you can see where this is going. They're going to forward it on to additional people, and those people will send that letter back and send some money through, and so it goes on. It's a bit of a noise in the background. Is that okay?
Sorry, that's my phone.
Oh, okay. I thought it was from my line.
No. Keep going.
And so I think that another similarity, too, is with Nigerian letters. And I have had some people say to me, oh, Nigerian letters and the advance fee fraud 401 scam, I was going to say 420 scam, that is not the same thing as chain letters, but I still think that there are some similarities there in the way that they are replicated to multiple people. You can't expect or believe that if you receive a Nigerian letter that it's only being sent to you. Of course, it's being sent to multiple people. And of course, there is that tactic or the element of fear that if you don't comply with them, then somehow that person on the other end is suffering.
I read an article dating back from 2007 where you talked about your experience trying to become a skeptical psychic.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about this experience? First of all, what motivated you back then to say, well, I want to run this experiment, I want to try this out?
Well, this actually goes back further than 2007. I was working with the Australian Skeptics at the time, and I was one of their investigators, and one of the members of the New South Wales committee that I worked with said I came across an advertisement in a newspaper looking for a psychic to go along to cafes and to do readings for people. And he said, why don't you, as part of an investigation, become a psychic? And I thought that was a really interesting idea. And I was at university at the time. I didn't really have the means to undertake that investigation. But then a couple of years later, I noticed online there was a job advertised through some employment website, and they were looking for psychics. And it turned out to be an American company called Absolutely Psychic. So I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with them. And they were seeking psychics from other countries, from Mexico, from Australia, Canada, and of course the States. And they were seeking people who speak different languages too. And anyway, I got in contact with them, and I thought, what the hell, I'll go through this process and see if I can possibly be offered a job with them. And so up front they told me that there were only about 1% of applicants who would be accepted. So I really think my chances were too good. Here I am, a professed skeptic. And anyway, they put me through quite a grueling process of interviews. Initially there was an email reading that I had to perform. So basically they wanted me to prove my powers. And so there were all of these different rounds of tests that they put me through. And I had to do a chat room reading at one stage, and everything culminated with a telephone reading. So I had someone from the States who phoned me and did a psychic reading with me and basically asked me a bunch of questions, and I just did a cold reading. I didn't use any hot reading techniques, but I just spoke about generalizations and
based on age and gender and all kinds of things.
Oh, yes, and just using everything that we know from the Fora effect, just talking about opposing things. And I spoke with a woman, so I made some assumptions about her and relationships and finances, and based on her, the age that I guessed that she was at too. And she seemed extremely impressed. And the upshot is that they offered me a job. So I was one of the 1% in this case. And I didn't actually...
I really wonder how many really make it into that 1%. It must be quite high.
I think it's pretty high, yeah. I think the 1% is more than 1%. But I didn't go through with it. I didn't sign the contracts. But I did a huge investigation into them, into the company, not only my own experiences, and spoke with people who had worked for them and had been ripped off in a financial sense. They were... did believe that they were psychic and they were earning a piddling amount of money, so it was really a waste of their time. So on many levels, it was a scam.
Well, and plus the 0555 or number or whatever it is that were the hotlines were and I believe still are unregulated.
I don't actually know about that, but
at least as far as when the article was written, it had by then been unregulated.
Right, right.
I don't know currently, unfortunately, my research ends somewhere around 2007, 2008, but as of then, yes, it seems that it was unregulated, and I wouldn't be surprised if it still mainly was.
Yeah, I would agree with you there, and I think it is a difficult thing to regulate, but essentially I put together an article and published that and then started receiving some legal threats from Absolutely Psychic, and they wanted me to take out their name from all of my articles, and I just refused to do that. In fact, I went to the opposite extreme and started publishing it wherever I could to get as much attention as possible.
What are the laws in Australia regarding that? Is it similar to Britain's libel laws, or is it closer to America's, like, say whatever the hell you want?
Oh, you know, I'm really not that familiar with the laws, and the article I wrote quite some time ago, so I can't really answer you there. I'm sorry.
But you didn't get in any trouble or anything else? They didn't try to pursue any kind of legal action?
Oh, well, they threatened me. They contacted the University of California at Berkeley, where I was working at the time, and they just didn't proceed with any threats. I think it was basically, I think their concern was, or their premise was, that they did not offer me a job, and I had the contract to prove it. So when I disproved their claim, really they had no leg to stand on.
Right. So they were just trying to basically scam their way into suing you.
Absolutely. I think they were just trying to threaten me and scare me, which is one of the reasons I'm here talking with you today, I think.
Well, you had to imagine that would have been probably one of the consequences, that these guys, they don't want the tricks of their trades being told, and they certainly don't want anyone looking under the hood.
Oh, no, no. And they did actually supply me with a lot of information about how I could be a legitimate psychic and what kinds of things I should avoid saying and doing, but they deny that they used scripts or anything like that.
And for people who are not aware, I remember the part of the article I talked about many of the scams, the literal scams that had been going on with the Miss Cleo group, where they had been billing people, even though they were telling them there was like 3 free minutes and billing dead people, apparently, or something like that.
Yes, and I think it's just a fact of life for skeptics that usually when we do have some kind of headway with the things that we are up against, it's going to be some kind of consumer affairs issue instead of being a question of scientific reality.
Well, my question in terms of your article was, and also their response to it, is generally speaking, how much good does that do? Like, are there a lot of people that are just simply unaware that it's just a giant scam, that as soon as they read it, they realize, oh, I've been tricked? Or is it much more of a slow process?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat that again? You sort of cut out there a little bit.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, I'll repeat. My question was, is there, like, when you write an article in a paper or you try to get the word out there, do you notice that there's a fairly powerful and immediate effect, or is it a slow bleeding effect that you have to just keep on writing this? Or, you know, because obviously the response against it from psychics seems to be fairly strong. Is it because as soon as you're made slightly aware of it, people start really to just, you know, completely abandon it? Are they always on this on the edge of losing their quote-unquote faith in psychics?
Oh, I think that we've really got a wide range of responses, or even a lack of response. Often to the articles that I write, there's really no kind of feedback. Often, as you know full well, I'm sure, people will criticize you before they'll compliment you. So I do actually have a blog with Psychology Today as well, and I wrote a piece about cold reading. It was just an introduction to skeptical positions regarding psychics, and I had a lot of criticisms in response to that. So I think it's often the approach that we take as well as skeptics, that we don't have too much success in really converting people. I think this is a very passionate and sort of personal experience-based thing that people have as regards the paranormal, and usually they shut down. They're not really open to discussing their beliefs or having their minds changed.
Have you personally, in your professional experience as a paranormal investigator and claims, you know, for in psychic claims, have you noticed, have you had conversations with people? Do you know what the best approach tends to be like for the kinds of people that shut down like that? Is there a soft way that you can get to individuals and say, like, look, this is a major scam?
Well, I think when I'm writing, there's a faceless aspect to it. And if there's an article that I write maybe for Swift or in my column for my bad language column for Skeptic magazine, there will be potentially tens of thousands of people who will read that, and I'm never going to hear from them. I don't know if I've had any kind of effect or impact on them or not.
Well,
but I think that if we're talking about more of a sort of outreach-based thing, when we're dealing with the public face-to-face, you really need to treat people on an individual level and treat them as you find them. Really, it's just an individualist thing. And I think a lot of skeptics aren't really that experienced in that area. And I think more skeptics should really do things like attend psychic presentations and talks given by pseudoscientific practitioners and therapists, because I think a lot of skeptics aren't really aware of what we should be skeptical of. They know what a psychic is and what a psychic claims to be, but they haven't ever been to a psychic. They can't speak from experience, and usually that is an argument that we receive from believers as well, that, well, you haven't seen this particular psychic, so how could you possibly know whether they're real or not, whether they're fake or whether they're talented. So it's really just an approach that you want to take, I think, on an individual level. Deal with the person as you find them, and just try to be as reasonable and rational as possible.
Well, I think that you pointed out in one of your talks, I think this was in a 2010 talk, that people sometimes they balk at the idea that a conspiracy theorist is technically a skeptic, because for them, I think their skepticism has certain kinds of connotations automatically that they associate, but they don't realize it's more of a process, and sometimes that process can be bad. And I think that in the case of, say, psychics or even the paranormal, things that most people are it's not part of their everyday experience, they don't really care about it, and they'll have an immediate skepticism towards it, but an informed skepticism is probably what we want instead, because the other kind, I think, is you can be right without knowing how it is that you're right.
Exactly, and I think we don't want to talk about things that we're unfamiliar with, that we don't understand, and we should inform ourselves as best as possible. And if we don't know something, to say we don't know, and to get the contact details of that person and go and investigate that, or send some skeptical literature. But, yeah, I think we want to be informed about the things that we write about and talk about.
How do you think you can define a good skeptic from a bad skeptic in sort of like a short one-sentence way, or maybe a two-sentence? I'll give you two.
Well, I was discussing this with my husband the other day, Matthew Baxter, and we were talking about how you have these sort of different factions in skepticism, and the don't be a dick faction, and then you've got people more maybe from the atheist side of things, that we should be not necessarily militant, but we should just call a spade and be outspoken and speak our mind. And our conclusion was that, again, it's that individualist approach. You need to really use whatever techniques or methods are best for you. You need to be yourself, be the skeptic that you are, and to go out there and do your thing, and it will affect someone. So really there's no right or wrong way to be. Just occasionally there might be a right or wrong way to be when you're addressing a particular audience.
Right. Well, I think that the best way to probably describe that is to say that there are ranges of behaviors for any individuals, because that's what you would expect. We're not all perfect clones. You know, we have our own kind of mix and blend.
Yeah.
And, you know, that in that regards, it's why all the different spectrums need to really be covered, and covered well. You know what I mean? Like, if someone's going to be angry, it might as well, it should be a delicious anger. And if someone's going to be, you know, all on the peace full side, then they should be just chill as fuck.
Yeah.
So I think there's a kind of, we should recognize in what ways those approaches are good and bad. I think that's the challenge, right? Person's solution is to be, you know, accommodationist, there is a bad and a good version of accommodationist.
Oh, yeah. And I think that, well, my preferred method is humor anyway. I think that a lot of beliefs and practices are quite ridiculous, and I often like to just present people's opinions and what they say, and let them dig their own grave for themselves. Really, that's usually the best way to sort of present them. But I like humor and comedy. I think there's a lot of humor to be found in skepticism.
Well, speaking of humor, I wanted to talk about, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, Ronpology? There's apparently a practice of reading someone's ass. I don't know what it's called.
Well,
did I say that?
I think there are lots of different names for it, but Rumpology, that's, I think, the term that Jackie Stallone gave to the practice. I mean, you can read anything when it comes to divination, whether it's reading entrails or shells or body parts, you know, palmistry, iridology, reading the eyes. You can read any part of the body or basically say that you can. Rumpology is reading the shape and the folds of the backside.
I don't know what kind of things you could divine from the backside. I think it might make cold reading a little bit more difficult. You know, there's not a lot of facial reactions.
I
think that's probably the strongest source of information. No?
I don't think it would be too difficult. I think if you just came up with generalizations again, and I went to a seminar in Australia a long time ago, and it was called Toe Story, and it was about a woman who professed to be able to read people's toes, and so she would just look at the different lines and markings on the toes and would just make generalizations about people. So I think it's just like that. It's just slightly more humorous.
Well, was there one woman who also said she could tell if someone had been raped based on the feet?
That was this woman, and I can't remember the name of the book, but she was referring to a particular book that, to my knowledge, is the only book that is out there about reading the toes psychically. But yes, she claimed that she had been able to tell that a client of hers had been raped because of the lines on her toes, on her toenails or something like that. But I think it would have been cold reading, and that person probably went to see her and was troubled and somehow fed that information to her, just classic cold reading of the toes.
I also liked the one about how you could try to predict someone's sexual habits from their handwriting. I tried it myself. I'm apparently number 12 on your list, which is very selective about who I sleep with.
Oh, is that true?
You know, it's unfortunately very true.
No.
I was selective. So I'm like, damn it, I wish it would have been something completely outrageous.
Yeah.
Like, does not masturbate. I'm like, you don't know me.
Well, yeah, I think in light of all of the other options there, and you might want to include this with the show notes as well, that little graph. But I think, yeah, you got off pretty easily.
I did. I think I got the best one.
I think so.
Accidentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, you are choosy. Oh, good. I'm not sexually frustrated or any of the other countless horrible ones.
Yeah, really offensive ones.
And what about the one where you can cure yourself of problems or diseases by changing your handwriting? What is this exactly?
Oh, that's called graphotherapy, and that's a basic belief that our handwriting can reveal illnesses that we suffer. And so that is the case with a few rare amount of conditions, and even then it's not so much a symptom as just something that is a representation of that illness somehow. So with Parkinson's disease, for example, the handwriting does become different, and
it's shaky.
Yes, that's right. It affects the way that you write. So it's more the way you write rather than your handwriting as such.
Oh, I see.
But there are certainly people out there who claim that they can tell if you've had a heart attack or if you're going to have a heart attack, and to be able to detect all kinds of mental disease as well. And so the premise is with graphotherapy that if you can diagnose disease using handwriting, then you can actually cure disease. So if you change your handwriting, then you can change your life. You can change your health. You can change other aspects of your life as well.
Well, that must not be a very popular one, because I don't think I ever really heard of it. And I did. I had that big that skeptics. What was it called again? The Skeptics Encyclopedia, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I must have skipped over that one. But there, it is this surprising amount of nonsense. It is a bit overwhelming to know it all, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's really boggles the mind that people believe in these things. But at the same time, there's kind of a very illogical logic to them. I'm not saying that there's anything to them, but to someone who doesn't know better, of course they would make sense.
Well, they have to have an internal logic is what it seems like. You can't just, it must have some degree of consistency. I think that that's one of the ways that people are tricked into thinking it's logical. Right?
Oh, and I certainly think these appeal to a lot of logical fallacies too, like the appeal to antiquity, that if these traditions have been around for a long time, that there must be something to them. I think that plays into it a lot as well.
Appeal to authority. There's also the personal anecdotes.
Absolutely.
They love that one.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you had to try to dissuade a person from using a personal anecdote as proof?
Oh, I think that's probably something that comes up every time I butt heads with a believer. Really?
Yeah, you'd probably be rich if I gave you even just a penny every time that happened.
More rich than I would be if I addressed a chain letter, let's put it that way.
Well, yes, I mean, but you never know, right? That's the whole point of a chain letter, you just never know.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I do receive chain letters from skeptics, and I'm not going to name names, but I do.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm not sure as well. With a lot of the modern chain letters that you receive via email, then they're all kinds of stories and parables, obviously not for the skeptic, but just a lot of stories that I think people find are interesting or pertinent somehow, so they do forward them on.
Well, you must have been tracking them for a while. Are they evolving? Are they becoming more sophisticated? Is our perception of them also evolving? Like, is there a predator prey kind of evolution happening?
I don't think. I think they've retained a lot of the older aspects of them. I think they've changed, obviously, in the format more than anything else, that you receive emails instead of receiving the handwritten ones. I can't remember the last received one in the mail, but then again, you have different variants of that. You've got direct mail outs for prayer, so you might receive from some kind of cyber church, or not a cyber church, but from some kind of ministry. They might send out one of those prayer rugs. Have you ever seen those before? Have you ever received
one? I did receive once one of those little prayer bracelet thing, or was it like a very cheap lead Mary or something like that? Like, pretty much looked like it was poison.
Yeah, they'll often have these very tacky little tokens, and they'll send them out, and then people, especially believers, religious believers, they will feel indebted to send some kind of donation for that, as though they've received something of value. So I think that's really the modern incarnation of receiving chain letters, in a sense, through the mail. But as far as emails are concerned, then really chain letters and chain emails are disguised as a number of different categories of emails. You know, some are special offers, and others are maybe Christmas stories, festive stories, and really just anything that could appeal to a wide range of people. It might even be, as you saw during my talk, cute pictures of koalas giving hugs to people, and you just want to send that on to people so they have a good day, that sort of thing. Really, it just covers the range of possible things that people might like to receive and pass on to loved ones.
So you can finally explain why the internet is so full of cats.
Even then, no.
But I mean, the percentage of the internet that is cats, I just want to put that out there, is significant.
I even
saw a guy. This is not a joke. He was a religious dude, and what he did was at the first 30 seconds of his video are cute cats, and then he delivers a religious message because you got suckered in.
Very subtle. I haven't seen that. That's clever.
That's clever. I was thinking about doing the same thing with puppies, sort of like playing with a bit of puppies, and then as soon as everybody's nice and comfortable, I lift one up and say, "There is no God," and I put him down, and then all the puppies play. And
there you go. Yeah, that would really be sneaky. I don't think people would be expecting that, but I've got a very cute cat, and so maybe I should start using her in my articles, a picture of her.
I think you should put her on the book.
To lure people in and you get them into this false sense of security and then throw skepticism at them.
Right in their face. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your book should have like a picture of a cat on it.
Obviously, it's appealing.
Like, super cute, huge eyes. And, you know, the first part of the opening chapter is like, I just tricked you, and that's part of the whole mechanism.
Part of the lesson.
I'm going to talk to you.
Exactly.
You have a justification for using a really sneaky trick to sell like fucking $1 million.
I think we need to start marketing like the believers, so that might work.
Yeah, well, sometimes don't you feel like we kind of handicap ourselves? I mean, the truth makes us a little bit solemn and uninventive sometimes, don't you think?
I think that's definitely the stereotype, and that's why I think humor will ultimately or hopefully overcome that. I think that's really one of the best approaches.
Yeah, no, well, I definitely try to rely on that. You probably never listen to my show, but I like to think I'm funny.
I don't know what to say now, but...
Don't say anything.
I can't
keep
up with everything. There's so much skepticism out there.
Oh, well, please. You know, it's not necessary. Besides, you know, truth be told, you are sometimes a host on Point of Inquiry podcast. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes, I finished earlier this year.
Yes. Now, I tried to locate some shows that had you in it, but that proved to be a bit too tricky for me. Or a bit too lengthy, so unfortunately I didn't really get to listen to your radio thing. But I can already tell, just at least from the interview, that you're probably pretty damn good at it.
Oh, well, thank you. I had some very interesting people that I interviewed during the time that I was there. It was my understanding that the position was for me to interview a lot of grassroots people and skepticism, and I also had a few big names in there too, like Adam Savage. So that was really a wonderful experience to get to meet these people and speak with them about skepticism.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of trying to fill in your shoes now, because that's what I've been doing for a little while. My view is to try to get people that individuals might not be aware or that are really on the cusp of being known, because there are so many different circles, because like we talked about before, there are kind of different strategies. And most of the people who listen to my show, you know, particularly because for the most part, I think, you know, I've been on the I'm an angry son of a bitch kind of side of things, and that's what people like. You know, they listen to me because they need something. Many times, they need someone that vents their frustration of living in a religious world.
Oh yes,
this is the kind of service I provide.
I can understand that perspective.
Exactly right. It's a service. I'm like, let me be your righteous indignation. But you know, business can be good that way. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't want individuals to be only exposed to that. So in my interviews, what I try to do is cover a very, very wide range of individuals. And when I saw your talk, I thought to myself, you know, we don't really deal with psychics altogether that much, because I think we believe they're small fry. We don't really care. They're like, what's the harm? Right, which is probably what you get all the time from people.
Oh, yes, and I think there's considerable harm. excuse me. I think there's considerable harm. I mean, obviously, if we think in terms of psychics that dabble in the occult and claim that they can either put curses on others or do curse removal. I was writing about this quite recently and coming across articles about psychics very recently, one in particular who ripped off a family of $450,000, another psychic in the Bay Area in California who ripped off an 85-year-old woman, told her that if she didn't pay money that her husband would die, and I think she put up about $150,000. So there, if you go and Google psychic and bilking or some phrase similar to that, you'll see the real-world dangers of dealing with psychics. And then just on a day-to-day basis too, just believing that you're going to be given a glimpse into the future, or that someone's going to be able to communicate with a deceased loved one. I mean, there's very real psychological harm there. So financial harm, psychological harm, it's of great concern. And I think there are a lot of things that skeptics are concerned about when it comes to alternative medicine. That's a very important area. But I think psychics, because of the prevalence of them, is so widespread in Canada, your country, in the States, Australia, where I'm from. So this is something that we should all be concerned about.
Well, they're in newspapers every day. They still have columns about ridiculousness.
Oh, yes. I've been looking at for something I was writing recently about those almanacs, the farmers' almanacs. I think they're a very interesting thing. And in their own way, it's a kind of psychic prediction. But if you pick up one of those, and I guess the new ones are going to be coming out for next year shortly, and you have a look at some of the classifieds in there, there are all kinds of psychics who claim that they can win back ex-lovers for you and put curses on people. And
Put the old gypsy curse on someone.
Yeah, the voodoo curses and all that sort of stuff. So it's out there. It's everywhere. Horoscopes. It's really a day-to-day thing. And even more obvious, I think, in the States. I don't know what it's like in Canada. But in Australia, we certainly don't have actual businesses for psychics. In the States, you have psychics who set up shop in a house somewhere and advertise. And it's a lot more driven underground in Australia. It's certainly still there. But in the States, it's big business.
It's in Canada as well. I mean, you can drive past some places in suburbia and see a big neon sign that advertises tarot readings, psychics, or, you know, even sometimes a couple of the rare ones. I think I saw one iridologist, not a phrenologist. Not phrenologists. Who are the people that can read your feet? What are they called again?
Don't know. Oh, well, you mean reflexologists or?
Yes, I mean, that's right. Some reflexologists.
Yeah, yeah. I think that they don't claim necessarily that they can read your feet, but rather that various parts of the foot are connected to other organs in the body, and that through massage and manipulation, I mean, it's really just a foot massage, that they can somehow cure disease. And
at least they give you a service, the foot massage.
That's right. But I mean, let's again call a spade a spade. It's the same thing with psychic mediums. You know, you might say, well, I'm doing a service to people and I'm helping them through their grief, but you are not doing what you are advertising that you're doing. So it's false advertising and it's lying to people.
Well, you talked about the importance of humor. You know, one of the days that comedy died was when Andy Kaufman died, and he went to a psychic surgeon thinking that was going to cure him. So that's another one where, where's the harm? Be like, ask Andy Kaufman's family what the hell the harm is in psychic surgery. That one is also pretty, like with faith healers in particular, because they prey on individuals that have ailments, like real physical ailments, those are really, they rank pretty high as far as I'm concerned in terms of the harm meter.
Well, I've got a personal story with that as well. My uncle had a rare form of thyroid cancer. I think when people normally think of thyroid cancer, they think it's just one of those safe cancers and that a lot of people survive them. But he had a rare form and he needed to have his thyroid taken out. He needed to be on thyroid medication. His prognosis wasn't terribly good, but instead of doing a lot of orthodox things as he should have, he went to the Philippines and he had psychic surgery. So that was really a time-wasting thing in his case, and he's now deceased, but that was just a very unfortunate thing. And it does happen in this country as well. It is usually under the guise of something like aura reading and aura healing or faith healing, so not so much psychic surgery. I think a lot of Americans would poo-poo the idea of that, but it is certainly happening, just different names.
Right, a different manifestation of essentially the same thing.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm going to cure you or some people who decide that they're going to cure themselves of Lyme disease using positive thinking.
Yeah.
Or,
well,
you know.
That's even easier. I mean, you don't need the chicken blood and the chicken entrails, do you? You can just wave your hands over someone and say that you've done the job.
Well, one of the components that I think you had mentioned, or maybe it was Michael Shermer that had mentioned this, but you talked about it in one of your talks, was essentially that there are multiple components of the psychic experience. And it seemed to me that part of those components seemed to be the senses, really. Like that for smell, you needed incense and burning candles, that you needed to have like a physical component, that you needed to make people feel reassured and that they had a friendly face. So are these more, is it better to describe them as just kind of experience, like physical experiences that you're just trying to create in order to make like a, you know, a significant impression on someone?
Well, I think it is. I think it's not only fulfilling stereotypes. When someone goes to a psychic, they're going to expect some degree of that in the service. They're going to expect candles or incense and tarot cards, props and things like that. I also think that it really weighs in very heavily to the psychological experience, that people think, well, if there are these specific tools, then somehow this is professional, somehow this is structured, somehow this is scientific and real. But you're right, Michael Shermer did indeed write about that. I've written about that, but certainly a lot of these ideas come from a mentalist by the name of Ian Rowland, and he's written, I think, the Bible for cold reading, the full facts book of cold reading. And so he is really the first person to describe a lot of these techniques. So people should check out his book. You can get that online, I think, through.
It'll be in the notes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm going to do a good job with the notes, particularly because I hope that by the end you'll have a bunch of selections of books that you can also recommend to people. You don't have to mention it on the podcast now, but if you can think of anything before I put the show up, I'm sure everybody would really appreciate it, because there might be tons of books that individuals were just totally unaware of.
Oh, I'm on, I'm on the crest of a wave myself with everything I'm doing.
Are you on Goodreads at all? Have you used this service?
I haven't. Tell me about that.
No. Goodreads is a service where you're able to go on and it basically displays all of the books that either you have read or that you want to read, and you can rate them and people can follow you. It's a way of, you know, making people aware of what you're reading. And certain individuals, like certain influencers, I think they should have that kind of service. I mean, like, invest like a couple of hours, put in all the books that you've read, and essentially what you do is it's spreading these books. It's kind of a cool way of just tapping into that.
Oh, I guess it's like Amazon recommends for you, but in a more public format. But that's a very good idea.
Exactly, and it functions also through Facebook, and because everyone just uses that.
So as long as you're not reading anything embarrassing, 50 Shades of Grey.
No. As long as you don't advertise that you're reading it, that's just, you can read it. That's private.
Yeah.
But I look at it more, you know, at least for because there are some people that just follow what I read just because they're curious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part of being a semi, like an internet public figure.
Right.
But I figure anybody else who has, you know, just who has read unusual books and who's also being pretty active in the scene, I think should just get on that, because it's pretty useful. And we are all readers. Like, that's the one thing about this community.
Yeah.
We're all hungry for more information. We want more, not less.
Oh, we are. And a number of fellow investigators of mine, including Ben Radford and Blake Smith from Monster Talk, we're putting together a bit of a library at the moment of books that we own, so we can kind of compile those and share them. So I think that's a good idea.
What I think Goodreads is right there. That's what
version of doing. If you've got some friends that you can trust with your books, if you want to get together with them and say, hey, I've got these books, what have you got? And then you can have a mini skeptical library. I mean, one day I kind of fantasize about having a big library along the lines of the one that James Randi has.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I know. I've had similar kind of desires, except for in mine, my crazy library, some of the, like, there's technology, but it's all hidden. So I got a bookshelf that would be a really nice TV in my gaming system. But, you know, it's not because I'm ashamed of it. It's just that I'd like the old aesthetic of the old school gentleman's library.
Oh, yeah. You have to wear the smoking jacket and everything.
I totally have to have a smoking jacket. And if the room doesn't have a fireplace, I won't know what to do.
Perfect.
Now, I want to talk about a bit about your past and why, for instance, it would be surprising for people to know that studying linguistics would make a person be, a big skeptic.
Well, I think when I started in skepticism, I was concurrently studying linguistics too. I don't mean to offend those in English literature out there, but I started doing that and I thought, no, this is not really what I'm interested in, iambic pentameter and all of that. I was more interested in the scientific side of language.
Its root and its, sort of like the basis for commonalities between other languages?
Well, I think everything from the origins of language to the different levels of language, whether it's looking at sounds or whether it's looking at grammar or whether it's looking at meaning, I really wanted to look at the nuts and bolts of language. And so I somehow stumbled across linguistics and got into it. And really, it blew my mind, I think, for the first year that I was studying it. It was just questioning a lot of the beliefs, long-held, cherished beliefs that I had and stereotypes and biases about language. So I knew that I was on the right path for that. But as I said, I was concurrently doing skepticism at the same time. And I just found over time that there were a lot of claims and things that we're interested in skepticism, science and, pseudoscience and the paranormal, that linguistics could really be very useful to help in debunking claims and in just having more of a scientific perspective on these beliefs and practices.
Well, you mentioned, I think, in psychic phenomena that it's important to have a type of language that you're using, certain phrases that everybody expects. And are there just sort of key words that just set us off?
I think that more than anything, that's probably a tradition. I'm not sure if there are any specific words or phrases that we should use. I think that if you're talking about maybe psychic mediums, just the stock phrases that they use are going to work with a lot of people. So I think it's just become more of a tradition than anything else.
Well, you think the stock phrases aren't necessarily a manifestation of a way in which the language can be manipulated and more of a way in which the tradition functions? Because I would say maybe it's not necessarily just the traditional part. Maybe it really is if it's catchphrases, for instance, and, it's just sort of like just easy phrases that are universal. Maybe that does mean that it's more of a language trick.
And that's a possibility, too. I think it depends on the psychic once again, but certainly if you receive a message from a deceased loved one that they love you or that they're sorry for something, they apologize for something that they did, that they had some kind of message for you before they died, then these things are going to resonate because these are common human experiences, really. There is a possibility that these things are what we want to hear, what we expect to hear, and then that becomes the tradition as well. But, there's certainly a lot of old chestnuts that are used by psychics, and I think people expect to hear those too. It's part of the shtick.
Part of the shtick. And your own fascination with language led you to work on a project that seemed, fascinating to me, but unfortunately very difficult to understand, which was the Script Encoding Initiative. Now, you're probably more experienced at explaining all of this than me, so can you please explain it to my listeners? What the hell is that?
Well, it's a project that ended quite recently. We just finished with our funding for that, and it was a joint project between a group at the University of California, Berkeley in the linguistics department and the Unicode Consortium. And so what we were doing, it's actually a friend of mine, her name's Debbie Anderson, she started this project. And what she wanted to do was to get a lot of endangered writing systems encoded into the Unicode before a lot of these fonts and writing systems were just lost to the computer age. So there was really a small window of time that we had in order to be able to execute this, and we did. We were dealing with about 110 different writing systems. Not all of them became encoded in the end. There were some which were undeciphered, therefore we couldn't really encode those. But basically it was taking writing systems of modern and ancient ways of writing, so alphabets and other writing scripts, and putting them into a format where they're compatible with computers. I think a lot of people, you can download fonts on the internet for various writing systems, but it's not exactly the same thing. Usually that that font has to be input into a Word document or something like that. But this is just being able to use these fonts in general on the internet and on computers to make sure that they're not relegated to some kind of a dustbin over time.
So you felt that the pressure, the selective pressure of the internet, is making a lot of languages disappear? Is that what's happening?
Not so much the case. It was definitely about keeping these writing systems alive so that they can be used in the computer age. I don't think that there was really any risk other than that the Unicode Consortium was going to just had this small window of time and they were going to stop encoding various symbols. And so we had to do this when we did it, and really it was the only time that we could. It's just about protecting them and preserving them.
I did find that sort of interesting because I suppose in a way, like I always try to think, what will the far-off future be like, and how will they analyze the things that we did? And one of the things that I find kind of fascinating, even about Unicode, is that this is basically a language that tries to encapsulate other languages into a different code.
Yes.
And from that, from a perspective of looking at it from, you know, this idea that you've never seen a computer in your life, you're a human civilization 10,000 years in the future, you don't even know that there, you know, you've just discovered that there was something called the internet, and now you discovered this whole Unicode thing. My question is, would there be a way, without you knowing any of this code, for a person to decipher not only that information, but decipher also the other language that had been Unicoded? Or is this all? Does all of this require one fundamental piece of information, which is an understanding of how the internet works? Otherwise, everything else just falls apart.
Oh, this is so beyond my expertise. I wasn't involved in any of the programming. My area was more kind of a sad area in many ways, trying to go through these writing systems and to work out whether they deserved to be kept around or not. It is very difficult.
Like the fidelity of the language translations kind of things, or how well they were understood? Was that one of the criteria?
How much data that we have to attest to them. So, for example, with a script from the... I'm just trying to think, and I can't think of the place now, but it's a script called Rongo Rongo, and not the Caroline Islands, from Easter Island. And so we didn't have enough data with that particular writing system to be able to attest to its existence not to attest to its existence, but to be able to decipher this language properly. So we couldn't go ahead and encode that one. So it was just working with a lot of user communities and seeing if there are sufficient users who are around today that might be actual people who speak that language and use that writing system, or academics who use that, scholars, to see whether it really deserved to be kept around, because a lot of it came down to funding as well. So it was just more of a social side of things too. And funnily enough, I think you could consider it to be at loggerheads often with what I do as a skeptic, because we looked at a lot of liturgical languages too, which were just used in ceremonies and religious rituals. And obviously I had to play the anthropologist rather than the skeptic in regards to those.
Right. Well, but even in that work, I'm sure it gives you another fascinating look into religion, and probably see many of the similarities just echoed throughout.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I am very interested in these things from an anthropological perspective. I mean, we're all humans, and these beliefs as cultural relics are very interesting.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the kinds of the different elements of belief, and looking at the way that each culture shapes those elements in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like you look at, say, Christianity and its strong focus on, say, the punishment element of religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's hell, fire if you don't obey, and things like that. And that's not a tradition that's being upheld by every single religion, but, you know, many religions have those kinds of element. Like in I think, in Chinese mythology, there'd be different levels of hell that you would spend a certain amount of time, like prison. Depending on your crime, there are different levels of this prison.
Like,
and then
purgatory.
Eventually you'd be released. Yeah, like a purgatory, or just a place because people feel that there should be retribution. You know, retribution is an important component of human nature.
Oh, yeah.
And it's present in our mythology. And depending on the religion, those elements are exploited differently.
Oh, I think that religions are often variations on a theme, and you've just got these different shades across religions that are these similarities, and obviously the differences kind of, I guess I could make an analogy to languages, that the farther away these languages are from each other, the more they develop their own distinctive elements.
Have you, are you much of a follower, you mean, of Noam Chomsky and Steven Pinker? Have you interviewed either of these two people in the past? Have you talked to these individuals?
I haven't. I've actually hit them both up to review my Language Myths book, but I'm certainly very familiar with them. I mean, Steven Pinker in particular is a fantastic skeptic.
Right. I've tried to get him on the show as well. I mean, I've read his book, Angels of Our Better Nature, and ever since then I've wanted to have him on the show. But he is a difficult person to nail down. I think you can testify to that.
Yeah, have you got his email address? I could probably get it for you.
Well, you could. I'd love to give that one a shot. I hope that I look legitimate enough that a person would be like, yeah, I'll go on his show. He looks like he's a straight-up shooter.
Oh, no, he is very interested in skepticism. So he subscribes to all the major magazines, and I think it's just a matter of him finding the time.
Yeah, I know, definitely with people that are, their time is requested on that level. I mean, even my wife, now that she's won that Guinness record and she's been featured in a whole bunch of newspapers, that kind of stuff, time is evaporating for her.
Wow.
it's becoming a tiny commodity. Yeah, she won a Guinness record for longest fire tooth hold because she breathes, she eats fire for a living.
That is bizarre and fascinating. Never would have known.
Yeah, those are descriptors from my wife right
no,
there.
You're pulling my leg.
I'm not pulling your leg at all. This is for real. And she's often a co-host on the show as well. Her name's Carissa.
Oh, very so, cool.
Yeah, well, and she's like you. She's a huge fan of James Randi. I can tell from the amount of times you've featured him in things and talk about him.
Well, I'm a research fellow for the James Randi Educational Foundation. So along with Steve Novella and Tim Farley and a number of other people. So we like to contribute to the Swift blog as much as possible and do our own investigations. So, yeah, we're media representatives for the JREF.
Well, you know, she would be infinitely jealous of you just because of that, because, you know, she has a background in magic, and she's just, you know, she's always wanted to kind of, like, you know, be like Randi. And,
oh,
you know, looks up.
Have you guys ever been, you've obviously been to the Amazing Meeting. Did she go along with you?
I've never been to the Amazing Meeting, actually.
Oh, I thought you had. I guess you were just talking about my talk this year, so you just saw that online. Yeah. Oh, well, you have to have to attend, and he is very friendly and easy to approach, so he'd love to meet her, I'm sure.
Well, it's not from a lack of desire. It's usually from a lack of funds.
I
understand. When I do this is what I do for a living. So as you can imagine, atheism is not really strongly associated with money.
I do know that, yes. Very, very few jobs in skepticism. I think you need to create your own product, which you are doing, and it's another thing to actually profit from it, though.
Exactly. Well, it's a slow process, but because of that, it puts a few kinds of, let's say, pressures that would otherwise, you know, like I'd go to the Amazing Meeting if I could, I'd go to Skepticon if I could, I'd go to all kinds of different ones if I could, but seriously, they would break the bank. It's an expensive thing to travel.
I understand, and there are usually scholarships that are offered, and also various media rates and things like that if you have a podcast, so that's all worth investigating too.
Well, I've tried in the past of getting myself invited, but I still think that for some individuals I might be a little bit maybe even too controversial for some.
Keep trying.
Well, I will, and you know what? Eventually, I'm sure, I'm 100% positive that one of these days my fans are going to pressure me to go somewhere and do something. But until then, I'm going to try to keep on finding interesting people to interview. And before we leave with that nice segue, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about this other book that you're working on called God Bless America. Can you tell me more about this book?
I certainly can. I've got a contract with a publisher called Pitchstone Press for this one. And so I'm hoping it's going to come out sometime early to mid 2013. So God Bless America is a book about the stranger beliefs and practices which are still around in the United States today.
Like the ones that snake handlers kind of a thing?
Absolutely. Definitely going to have a chapter on snake handling and glossolalia, otherwise known as speaking in tongues. There's a chapter on exorcisms. There's a chapter on voodoo and hoodoo and juju, looking at the Amish and Mennonites, Quakers, evangelists.
Sounds like a fun book.
Oh, it's really good fun. It's really coming together, and I'm finding a couple of interesting greater messages there as well in the book. I think initially a few publishers that I spoke with at first just thought it would be a book about me mocking these religious beliefs, but I just think there are some important messages within, and it's just amazing that a lot of these beliefs and practices are still around, and many of them are quite dangerous. For example, snake handling or...
Yeah, that is dangerous. I remember there was a couple of months ago, a pretty famous snake handling pastor died, and there was a... I'm trying to remember, was it New York Times or Washington Post? I forget who. Some journalist was there, photojournalist was there to kind of catalog the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see images of people. If they're not killed, then they're maimed, and they've got these gnarly, knobbly-looking hands and what used to be fingers, and it's a very dangerous thing. I mean, just the belief that they're being protected by God, it's just, it's ridiculous because they are getting harmed. And once again, further to your point earlier, talking about parallels across religions, I just did a chapter on voodoo, and it's amazing to see that a lot of people who practice voodoo, and it is quite a popular belief system in this country today. I think people think, oh, it's not really practiced, but there certainly are a lot of people, immigrants from Haiti, who are practicing it here, and they will cut themselves, they'll eat broken glass, and do all kinds of things to prove their faith.
And bite the testicles of goats, as seen on John Safran versus God.
I
don't know if you've ever seen that series. You've never seen it?
No, I have seen the series. I haven't seen that particular one, but now I'll have to tune into that.
Oh, yeah, it's when he goes to Haiti. It's pretty crazy.
Oh, it's very different there, what's practiced in West Africa, where the religion initially came from, and from Haiti. But still, with the influx of immigrants here, it is practiced. And, of course, you've got various watered-down forms like the Louisiana voodoo, which is just more of a cultural thing. But, yeah, it's certainly still around.
Well, I'm looking forward to the chapter on speaking in tongues from both your experience as a skeptic and as a linguist. So that should be a fairly interesting chapter.
Oh, yes, and I have actually had that performed on me in the past. I went to a charismatic church, and they did the laying on of hands on me and didn't cure me of anything. I didn't really have anything wrong with me in the first place, but it's a very interesting phenomenon, that one.
Also in John Safran versus God, did you see that episode?
No, I'll have to check in. I'll have to check that one out too. He's done it all first.
You're bad Australian. You're bad Australian. What the hell?
Oh, no. I'm very familiar with his other stuff.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your upcoming projects, which as soon as the book is out, I hope you'll come back on the show.
Oh, I'd love to. I've got a lot to say about that.
The book, first of all, sounds like it's going to be definitely a wild ride in terms of the somewhat lesser known crazies.
It's really fascinating, and I'm just trying to not only observe these things but also participate in them as well. So I'll be going to that end. I'll be going to a Quakers meeting this weekend.
Oh, so you're going to do a bit of gonzo journalism throughout the whole
thing? Oh, yeah. I think that's always been my style, really. I've wanted to get in the trenches and really just experience these things and not only write about them from an observer's point of view.
Well, I hope you're considering maybe also filming some of that.
I have in the past for some things, but, I should do that. But certainly when it comes to snake handling, I'm not going to test that one. I did want to actually find it. A snake handling church, and Blake Smith from Monster Talk, he's got an old snake handling church down the road from him, and so I'm thinking about the possibility of going and checking that out.
Well, here's what I would recommend if you're thinking about it. Maybe what you could do, because these are usually fairly successful, is you can figure out a budget if you want to do a couple of segments, and then launch a Kickstarter campaign for it. And you might be able to get enough people, considering the types of friends and connections that you have, you might be able to create enough interest so that you can include that. And once the book is out and you've got these videos, it'd be amazing.
Oh, yeah, that is a fantastic idea. I think there'd be a lot of interest in this. So, yeah, it's worthwhile me considering.
Well, if you have any questions about it, because I ran both the successful Kickstarter and Indiegogo campaign, I'd be more than happy to offer some recommendations and stuff like that. I mean, I've been trying to push people, like I pushed Jerry DeWitt to write his book, and I'm like, yeah, any support that I can give towards people who make good, you know, good quality stuff. It's like the same way I was saying before, right, where we separate the bad from the good. And you got to support the good.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You got to support them hard.
Yeah, I think we definitely need to come together as a community and to support people. And, yeah, certainly there's so much bad stuff out there. We need to meet that with some good stuff.
Yeah, I also don't want us to be the equivalent of Jesus junk. You know what I mean?
Indeed, yeah.
I want us to be proud, endlessly proud of the things that we can produce. And you know what? You're on that list of people that individuals should be paying attention to. So we're going to be included. Tons of links to your talks. And, you know, all the fans, you know, I'm going to be including her Twitter, too, so you can encourage her if she decides to do any of that video stuff, which I think would be just awesome. There's, I mean, especially if you do the Gonzo thing, and she's also quite attractive for those of you that don't know. So it should be perfect. Should be perfect combination.
Thank you, Jacob.
You're very welcome. Thanks for coming on the show.